It is great to be with you. Barb and I always look forward to our visits back here to the big city and to the mega church. And we are glad to be with you this morning. Just a quick update on my work. I'm grateful, continue to be grateful for the support that you give to us. And I've got a couple of exciting opportunities this not just this fall, but into the spring. I'm getting more and more opportunities in, we're still doing the work with universities and high schools and conferences and workshops and that kind of thing, but I'm getting more and more opportunities in pregnancy care centers, speaking at their banquets, which usually opens up other opportunities, particularly to do pastor's breakfasts the next morning following them. These are usually very poorly attended, as you would imagine, but they're great opportunities nonetheless, and I had one just this past week. In fact, I'll have another one this next week up in Michigan. But I've got a couple of opportunities, one in particular in South Carolina and then another one in Michigan in the spring, where I will be addressing small conferences of pregnancy care center directors. And there is a bit of a challenge, a bit of a need, I guess I would say, a great need in the pregnancy care center community with just the messaging of the pro-life message. And so that's something that I'm particularly excited about, and I'm having great opportunities there. So again, just grateful for your financial support, for your prayerful support, and so grateful for this church. There is a propaganda technique that has been employed for centuries by dictators, by politicians, by charlatans, by TV evangelists, by vacuum cleaner salesmen, and all kinds of other people, known as the big lie. And basically, the technique says make the lie big, keep it simple, keep saying it, and eventually people will believe it. And there is some truth to this, as you know. Oftentimes, the bigger the lie, the more outrageous the lie, the more likely that people are to believe it. In the big lie, there is what one man described as, quote, a certain force of credibility. Because most people would be ashamed to resort to large-scale falsehoods. It would never come into their heads to fabricate colossal untruths, and they would not believe that others could have the impudence to distort the truth so infamously, end quote. Now, hold on to that thought for just a minute. I'll return to it. I do want to say this. Yours is a church that has taken for a long time now, very seriously, the biblical commands to speak up for those who have no voice, to rescue those who are being led away to slaughter. Your stand for life and against abortion is well known in this community. In fact, I was on your website yesterday, and it was the first time I'd looked. I've been on it many times, but it was the first time that I looked at your mission statement or your mission, those bulleted points. And among, standing for truth and unity of believers and so forth, teaching your youth, equipping your youth, one of them was defending the defenseless. I wasn't surprised to see that. That is in your mission statement, and it is indeed your mission. In fact, it's the mission of every church. Your church just happens to acknowledge it, that this is the calling of the body of Christ. I know many of you are very adept at making the case for life, appealing to the science of human embryology to demonstrate that the unborn from the earliest stages of development are distinct living and whole human beings, and to appeal to philosophy to show that there's no moral difference between the adult you are today and the embryo that you once were that would justify killing you in that earlier stage of your development, but not now. And so I know most of you are again, quite adept at being able to do that. And so this morning, I want to take a little bit of a different approach here as we give attention to the sacredness of human life. And this is one that I hope will prove helpful to you in your continued battle, in your continued stand against abortion, your battle for life. I want to respond to the big lie. One that is so colossal in nature, so outlandish, and one that has been repeated so often that scores of people, even within the church, have not only come to believe but are now spreading with evangelistic fervor. And here it is. The big lie is that pro-lifers are not truly pro-life, they're only pro-birth. I'm sure most of you have heard this in some form or another. In other words, pro-lifers are irrationally and narrowly obsessed with saving the fetus, but have no regard for children once they have been born. And through this lie, we are portrayed as unfeeling, Neanderthalish hypocrites having what we are accused of having, a fetus fetish, caring only about fetuses and not about so-called real people. Now, this charge has been around for a long, long time. This is not necessarily new. But in the past couple of years, this has gained incredible traction as the media continues to push this narrative, causing untold damage to the reputation of pro-lifers, but more to the point, to the cause of the pro-life movement. And so here's what I want to do this morning. I want to consider the pervasive nature of this lie, the questionable motives behind it, and then I hope to set the record straight regarding our motives as pro-lifers and the ministry of the pro-life movement by answering the question, why do we as pro-lifers focus so narrowly on advocating for the preborn? So I want to start with a video. This is a short video. It's a little less than 4 minutes long. It's Jennifer Granholm, the former governor of Michigan, and talking head, and on her show here, she's dealing with this issue, and she's making this charge that we're not truly pro-life, but as pro-lifers, we're really only pro-birth. So turn your baloney detector up to about 6.3, and you'll see all kinds of things wrong with this. Go ahead, Hannah, if you would, go ahead and show that at this point. Am I too tall? Step aside.
The Republican Party platform includes support for the Human Life Amendment, which is also known as H.R. 212. It gives a fertilized egg inside the womb the same rights as a person outside the womb. It's designed to ban all abortions. Now, we all know how deeply the issue of abortion hits people in both parties. It is really hard. It's very sensitive. It's very personal. Now, there are no easy answers. But even if we're all divided over the question of when life begins, one thing we should agree on is this. Vulnerable children outside the womb deserve at least as much focus and care as those not yet born. Shouldn't those who are concerned about the lives of the unborn be equally concerned about the lives of the recently born? I'm honestly really troubled and perplexed about the distinction that is actually represented by the cervical wall. On one side, people should be prosecuted if they do anything to harm the fetus. But on the outside, sorry, kid, whatever happens, you're on your own. A 71-year-old viewer wrote to me this weekend and got me thinking about the terms that we use in this debate, pro-life versus pro-choice. Democrats have allowed the Republicans to frame the issue, and they have ceded the territory of quote-unquote life. Republicans are definitely pro-birth. They'll do everything that they can to make sure that the baby comes out, regardless of how it got in. But are they pro-life? You can be pro-life, I suppose, but you can't be pro-life and vote to cut funding that supports the life of a child. Paul Ryan's cut at all costs budget and philosophy, which 100% of the pro-life Republicans voted for, that budget would gut the funding that supports at-risk babies and children. Food stamps, temporary assistance to needy families, daycare, Head Start, early childhood education, child health care. At the state level, GOP governors are cutting the child protection workers who handle child abuse cases and neglect cases. You know, those awful public employees who must have caused the financial crisis. Programs that would benefit at-risk children outside the womb are all on the chopping block. For example, Republicans have introduced H.R. 3803. It's a bill called the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. The Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. And the bill to protect born children from pain is... Take a listen to what Sister Joan Chittister, a Benedictine nun, said on Bill Moyer's show in November.
But I do not believe that just because you're opposed to abortion that that makes you pro-life. In fact, I think in many cases your morality is deeply lacking. If all you want is a child born, but not a child fed, not a child educated, not a child housed, and why would I think that you don't? Because you don't want any tax money to go there. That's not pro-life. That's pro-birth. We need a much broader conversation on what the morality of pro-life is.
Preach it, Sister Joan. I say Democrats should not be afraid to talk about the morality of life, of caring for children who are born. It seems the Republican obsession with being pro-life lasts about 9 months. And after that, it's each baby for herself. So Democrats, let's be clear and strong. Being pro-birth is not automatically the same thing as being pro-life.
All right. I heard the snickering behind me. I think many of your heads are ready to explode, and rightfully so. Now, again, those outside of the church are not the only ones that are advancing this narrative, as you have seen here on the video. Many professing Christians, such as Sister Joan Chittister, are also advancing this narrative. Do not be surprised by her title. She is a leftist feminist nun. Okay. Now, this what I'm calling the big lie this morning, you've seen this all over Facebook and all kinds of Facebook memes. Jesse Ventura, the former governor of Minnesota, also has a video out there on YouTube along the same line saying that we're not really pro-life, we're only pro-birth. So this is everywhere. What I want to do is I want to share with you four quick responses to this charge. And so here's the first one. The first one is that even if this were true, that pro-lifers really didn't care about babies once they were born, this does nothing to defeat our argument that abortion unjustly ends the life of innocent human beings. This is, of course, an ad hominem attack. And I'm sure you know what that is, a logical fallacy whereby an argument is responded to by attacking the person or the character of the person or some other attribute of the person rather than attacking the substance of the argument itself. This is, of course, a popular tactic among the intellectually lazy and the intellectually dishonest in order to avoid the subject. But the question is, how does the alleged corrupt character of pro-lifers justify killing precious preborn children? How could not caring for babies after they're born justify dismembering them before they are born? Imagine, and some of you have heard this illustration before, but imagine if I said, well, at midnight, I'm going to begin shooting my kids one at a time. I've got five children, so every hour on the hour, starting at midnight, I'm going to begin shooting, killing my kids, unless you promise to adopt them. If you're unwilling to do so, does that justify my killing them? Well, of course not. Now, I want to insert here that normally, we do very well not to take the bait on this kind of a charge. In other words, not to become distracted by red herrings and ad hominem attacks. But because this particular lie has proved to be so damaging to the pro-life cause, and because it is espoused by so many professing Christians, I think it warrants careful attention. So I want to be clear. Normally, we want to stay focused on the million-dollar question, which is, let's see how well you know this stuff. What's the main question you want to stay focused on? Yeah, what is the preborn? That's the primary question. And this, again, is a tactic to get us off of that. So what I don't want to do here is I'm not offering this response today to make us defensive or to make us foolish where we would be drawn away from the main subject, but rather that we would be informed. And if nothing else, to be sure that none of us propagate the lie, which some of us perhaps would be inclined otherwise to do. So in the spirit of 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 5, I want to demolish this argument, this pretension that has set itself up against the knowledge of God and against the pro-life movement, and take it captive and make it obedient unto Christ. In other words, I want to beat the lunch out of it today, all right? And by doing so, amen. By doing so, preach it, Sister Joan. It's funny how they want us to preach it when we say what they believe. You know, that's the only time that they have room in their hearts for religion, apparently. But so by doing so, I hope that this will, again, put this to rest for once and all, and for all in all of your minds, knowing how to counter it. So here's the second response. This is, as I've already said, nothing less than a disingenuous effort to distract us and to silence our voice for the voiceless. And so let's be clear about this. This is not an attempt on the part of our opponents to garner greater concern for the poor from us. This is a red herring. This is an attempt to distract us from the main issue, which again is, what are they? What are the preborn? It's important to understand how truly baseless this charge is, but in order to respond to it properly, it's also important for us to understand the motivations behind it and to know what is in play here. This is an attempt by abortion supporters to redefine for us what they think our message ought to be. It's an attempt on their part to define for us what they want our movement to be about, and to do so in such a way as to undermine or to gut our effectiveness. In essence, this is an effort to render the pro-life label meaningless. Make no mistake about it. That's what's in play here. Jennifer Granholm and others in her camp argue that because we oppose abortion, we must also assume responsibility for every other social ill. We oftentimes hear from those on the other side of the issue, you're not really pro-life unless dot, 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 fill in the blanks. In other words, you're not really pro-life unless you're also anti-war, anti-death penalty, anti-gun rights. You're not really pro-life unless you support every welfare program. You're not really pro-life unless you support massive re-education and social engineering sex education programs. You're not really pro-life unless you champion universal health care and adopt every child that's at risk for abortion. Scott Klusendorf mocks the silliness of this. He says, you're not really truly pro-life unless you treat the deforestation of the Amazon with the same moral intensity that you do the unjust killing of a human fetus. And I love that quote. Of course, I have to. He's my boss. Some of you are familiar with Mark Newman, another big voice in the pro-life community. Mark Newman points out that the list goes on, this, you know, you're not really pro-life unless dot, dot, dot. He says the list goes on and on, taking us down a, quote, a slippery, never-ending, qualifier-laden slope. And he's exactly right. Francis Beckwith calls this the fallacy of pro-life exceptionalism, that pro-lifers must address every moral wrong along with the evil of abortion in order to be morally authentic. But those who address any other moral wrong except abortion don't have to address abortion in order to be morally authentic. And he's right. No other ministry or social cause is held to the same standard. Imagine saying to the American Cancer Society, you have no right to focus on curing cancer unless you also work to cure AIDS, heart disease, and diabetes. I mean, that would be ridiculous. On the surface, we would all recognize the absurdity of that. So what our detractors are demanding here is that we take our already thin resources and spread them even thinner by fighting every other social injustice imaginable. And the reason behind this, the reason that they insist on this, is because they are bent on destroying our influence. These are not our friends. Now, I don't mean to vilify everybody who holds an opposing position. I'm not saying that everybody who holds to a so-called pro-choice view is, you know, a fire-breathing, you know, atheist and hates our guts. I'm not saying that. But when people argue the way Jennifer is arguing, they are not our friends. Okay? Frederick the Great is credited with having said, he who attacks everywhere attacks nowhere. And that's exactly right. Now, I don't know about you, but I have a personal reason for saying that I'm really glad the American Cancer Society stays focused like a laser beam on fighting cancer. I don't want them fighting every other social cause or every other medical cause for that or every other medical issue for that reason. I want them to stay focused, and I assume that you would agree with that. Our critics love to lecture us. If pro-lifers really want to see a reduction in the number of abortions, they should broaden their focus and address the underlying causes that influence women to have abortions in the first place. This is like arguing that the underlying cause of spousal abuse is psychological, so instead of making it illegal for husbands to beat their wives, we should just provide counseling. Well, this is nuts. Providing counseling is much needed, but women also deserve legal protection, and so do the unborn. I'm convinced that many, many Christians, because this is, again, this big lie has taken hold even in many, many Christian communities. And I am convinced that many professing Christians have bought into this big lie in order to placate their own guilty consciences for not actively opposing abortions themselves. But even more so, or more often, I think that it's fear that causes so many Christians to give themselves over to this very popular self-loathing spirit that has taken hold of the church today. And I think this is born out of a grossly naive hope that by beating on ourselves, by piling on ourselves, that we can somehow appease our critics and cause them to like us or at least make them leave us alone. Some of you remember, I'm sure, probably most of you remember back in 2003, the very popular Christian song, If We Are the Body, by the Christian group Casting Crowns. Now, I don't know a lot of their music. What few songs I've heard of them, I really like the melodies. I think they're a very talented group. I assume the best of their Christian commitment. I'm not making any comment on that this morning. But they had this song back in 2003 that was, you know, very, very popular, If We Are the Body. And listen to the words, just a few of these words. They say this: if we are the body, why aren't his arms reaching? Referring, of course, to Christ's arms. Why aren't his hands healing? Why aren't his words teaching? And if we are the body, why aren't his feet going? Why is his love not showing them that there is a way? This is a really catchy tune. I admit I found myself singing along with it when I heard it. But the more I thought about this song, it really bothers me because songs like this play right into the hands of those who want to discredit us, reinforcing the lie that the church is filled with uncaring hypocrites who don't serve and don't go and don't do and don't sacrifice. And the fact of the matter is, His hands, Christ's hands, are serving. They are healing. His feet are going. His lips are speaking. Now, the church is not perfect, and I'll be the first to admit that. Should we do a better job of policing ourselves and holding ourselves accountable? Absolutely, we should. But no one loves, serves, or sacrifices like the church, which brings me to the third response. And it is this. Pro-lifers lead the way for people on both sides of the cervical wall in serving them and ministering to them. There's no question about this. Jennifer Granholm states, she says, quote, and this is taken from that clip that you watched. She says, it seems the Republican obsession with being pro-life lasts about 9 months, and after that it's each baby for herself. I have no interest this morning in defending the Republican Party, but I will defend the character of pro-lifers. When I hear this, I want to respond and say to people like Jennifer, are you kidding me? Are you serious? That's your argument? You really want to go there? You've got to be kidding me. I mean, that ought to be the first thing out of our mouth. Just this, you're joking, right? You don't really want to go there, do you? This is such a gargantuan lie, it is hard to believe that anyone dares to say such an outlandish thing, especially with a straight face. Not content to portray you and I as merely unfeeling hypocrites, Jennifer and her friends want the world to believe that we are waging a war on women. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Simply follow the money. We are the friend of women and of children, the pro-life community. There are right now somewhere around 560, 570 surgical abortion clinics in the United States. Now, these are run not exclusively, but primarily by men for financial profit off of women in crisis. Contrast that with the number of pregnancy care centers in the United States. About 2,100 pregnancy care centers in the United States, but that's a little misleading because many of those centers have two or three locations. So when you combine all of that, when you total that up, we've got about 2,700 pregnancy care centers, 2,800, somewhere between 2,700 and 2,800 pregnancy care centers in the United States. These are run not exclusively, but primarily by women, for women, at no cost to women. Providing diapers and counseling and free ultrasound machines. Most of these centers have what they usually call a baby boutique, okay, or a mommy market, where the clients that they're ministering to can go in. They can earn while they learn. They can through learning programs that they have, they can earn baby bucks to go in and get all kinds of things for their little ones. Okay. Most of these centers are connected with an OBGYN or a doctor in the community who provides free medical care for these women. Most of these centers have free attorneys available for these women should they choose to place their children for adoption. There are nearly 300 maternity homes in the United States alone today, the overwhelming majority of those run by Christians, pro-lifers. Plus, hundreds, if not thousands, of pro-life families opening their homes to pregnant teens, to pregnant women. I was just, as I mentioned earlier, I spoke at a banquet Thursday night in Missouri for the Pregnancy Support Center of Lebanon, Missouri. And they have, not only, I got a tour that day, not only of their pregnancy care center, which was incredibly impressive, but they also have a maternity home where they can house up to five women. And in addition to that, they have 10 rental units that they are making available at next to nothing to single moms. Many pro-lifers, as you know, probably some from this church, have stood outside on Webster Street years ago or in other communities with big signs saying, "We will adopt your baby." Families, couples willing to take in children. Right here in this church, I did some homework this week, right here in this church, here at Tech, you have very strong financial support for pro-life missionaries. I'm one of those, along with Scott Klusendorf and Dr. Christina Francis, as well as Seth and Ian with Created Equal. And by the way, I know that that's not a very satisfying response to the Jennifer Granholms because, again, they say we only care about babies until they're born. But much of the work that I and Scott are doing at Life Training Institute is partnering with pregnancy care centers to help them raise much-needed funds so that they can minister to moms who've had their babies and are raising their babies. Again, Dr. Francis giving her own time as an OBGYN, making trips to Kenya to provide free medical care to impoverished communities. Tom and Suja. Am I saying isn't her name right? Is that how you say it? Suja, not Suja? Suja, okay. In Africa, Tom working with indigenous people, teaching skills to make to help the folks there make a living by growing popcorn and making soap to sell. Suja, a doctor working as a medical missionary there, meeting the physical needs of children and adults. Again, missionaries supported by this church. For years, you were heavily invested financially and in other ways in the ministry of Friends House before they closed their doors, helping single women in need. Six families here, by Wendell's count, perhaps more, who have adopted children. Others serving as foster families, opening their hearts and homes to children in need. You have a strong benevolence ministry that for decades now has invested in people in need. Recently, having just sent $5,000 to Samaritan's Purse for hurricane relief. And again, Seth from your own congregation heading down there to Texas to help give relief there. Also, through Samaritan's Purse, you have supported Operation Christmas Child for many years. And the list could go on. And that's just this church. I could tell you about our church at Aletheia and many, many other churches throughout our nation. Here's the real story. The real story is not that the church is filled with hypocrites. Yeah, we've got a few of those too. But the real story is that the church is so full of people who throughout the centuries have labored and sacrificed their own resources to start hospitals, soup kitchens, rescue missions, women's shelters, orphanages, adoption agencies, etc., etc. It is Christians, pro-lifers, who drill wells in Africa, in Asia, and rush to every catastrophe to offer assistance. We advocate for those caught in the jaws of sex trafficking, and we minister to those with addictions. The story about Houston and Florida will be told by the church. It won't be reported on CNN. Fake news. All right? But it's not going to be told. That story won't be told by the media. But the real story is that Houston will recover greatly because of the part on the part of churches, Christians throughout the nation and Florida as well, who are going to go down and offer their time and sacrifice to build those communities back. That's the way it always is. And everybody knows this. The foster care system in America would collapse if it were not for thousands of Christian families who open their homes. It has always been this way. Hebrews 11. Centuries-old record that goes back to centuries before speaks of them shutting the mouths of lions, quenching the fury of the flame, routing foreign armies, and administering justice. That's what we do. We don't do it perfectly. And I'm not boasting this morning except in Christ, but this is what churches do. This is what Christians do. Slavery in England and America was ended because of the fiery opposition of Christians. Again, the church is not perfect, but who's doing it better? Planned Parenthood? Where are their orphanages? Where are their adoption agencies? Oh, they boast about being involved in adoption. Yeah, what a joke. Where are their maternity homes? Now, again, I'm not boasting. Nothing good, Romans 7, nothing good lives in me or in you apart from Christ. Any love or compassion that we have marshaled over the centuries as Christians to do the things that we have done, the many things that we have done, the hospitals, the soup kitchens, the rescue missions, and so forth, comes from Christ. We love because he first loved us. There is nothing like the church. And when it comes to caring for women and for children, the real scandal is not in the church, but in the so-called pro-choice community that has the audacity to lecture you and I, but does absolutely nothing to help children on either side of the cervical wall, to use the language of Jennifer Granholm. Again, where are their maternity homes? Where are their soup kitchens, their orphanages? They defend tearing children to pieces, and in fact, tear children to pieces like wolves before they're born, and then they ignore children who have been born. Sister Joan Chittister claims, quote, our morality, meaning you and I, our morality, she says, is deeply lacking because all we want is a child born, but not a child fed, educated, or housed. That we don't want, she says, any tax money to go to children that are born. This is obscenely and demonstrably a false accusation. We do not want to deny children food, clothing, shelter, or medical care. I don't know any pro-lifer that wants that. This kind of incendiary rhetoric shows the desperate measures that many abortion supporters will go to in order to protect the lucrative business of child killing. Lacking compelling arguments in favor of abortion, they are left to twist the truth and to spin lies about you and I. When we oppose certain government programs, it is not because we despise children after they're born. It is because so many of these programs do more harm than good. We are to care for the poor. Yes, James 1:27 is very clear about that. Pure and undefiled religion is this, to look after widows and orphans in their distress. But helping the poor is very distinct from making the argument, as so many do, that if you don't support a socialistic political system, you have no right to oppose abortion. When we oppose the encroaching, suffocating welfare state, it is not because we want children to starve. It's because we want children to thrive. When we oppose socialized health care, it's not because we want children who are suffering to die. It's because socialism is legalized theft, government-sanctioned stealing, resulting in rationed health care for children. We want these children to live. Compassion for the poor is the very reason that many Christians, pro-lifers, oppose a socialistic political system, because it hurts the very ones it purports to help. The church needs to reach out to the poor, but we have to do so with wisdom and discernment. Again, to quote Mark Newman, to suggest that one cannot be pro-life without supporting every government program would be like living in 1860 and arguing, quote, you can't be an abolitionist regarding slavery unless you support socialist financial aid for injured plantation owners. I love that. We are pro-life because it's wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings, and abortion intentionally kills innocent human beings. It's that simple, and it doesn't need any qualifiers. And that brings me to the final point. Response number 4. Pro-lifers focus narrowly on rescuing the preborn because the abortion industry and their allies focus narrowly on killing them. Those both outside and inside the church who demand that we assume responsibility for every other social ill if we're going to advocate for the preborn expose that either they are ignorant about what abortion does to children in the womb, or they just don't care. Those are the only two options. The lethal threat of abortion demands a robust, determined, laser-focused response from the church. Legalized abortion is the defining moral issue of our time. I don't have to convince you of that. This church is already convinced. But it is easy to conclude that pro-lifers have a so-called fetus fetish, or that we're focused too narrowly on the preborn, when you never have to see what abortion does to unborn children. Romans chapter 1 speaks of God's wrath being revealed from heaven against those who, quote, suppress the truth by their wickedness. It describes them as being full of, quote, every kind of wickedness and full of murder, and says that they invent ways of doing evil. Nowhere is that evil invention more manifest than in the methods that evil men have devised to abort precious preborn children. Abortion is the intentional and unjust killing of innocent human beings at their most vulnerable stage of development in the most barbaric manner imaginable. Abortion dismembers, decapitates, disembowels, and burns little girls and little boys from their mother's wombs in the name of choice. In 1991, when I was pastoring this church and living here in Fort Wayne, some of you remember this. I think Eric and Carrie might remember this because I think you were there, maybe not. But we and Jenny, we had a Bible study that met in our home, and there was a young man here in the community, not part of this church, but he had lifted from an abortion clinic dumpster in Detroit a little baby girl, a little African-American baby girl who was about 5-6 months old. I don't really remember. All I remember was he had lifted her body from the dumpster with the intention of giving her a proper burial and then photographing this little one and exposing the fruitless deed of darkness to the world. And in the meantime, Barb and I had this little girl in our care for one night. And I don't know if you were there, but the next you were. Okay, you're remembering this. The next morning, we had a Bible study that met at like 7 o'clock or 7:30 in my home one morning. And I had a group of high school students there. And we took that little baby and we walked, I walked around the room with that little girl on a cloth diaper. She was perfectly, perfectly formed, looked like a little baby doll. Her body was still intact because she had been aborted by a saline solution abortion, so she had not been dismembered, although her skin was radically discolored. And I remember walking around our living room and showing that to the students, and there was silence in my living room. And I would never do this for so many obvious reasons. I did it there because I had a license to do it there. At least I took license to do it there. But I cannot tell you how many times I've wished I could take that little baby to university campuses and hold her out and say, you tell me that this is not a human being. You tell me that this is a human but not a person. This is barbaric, what abortion does to children. Dr. Willie Parker, in his recent book, recent release, titled Life's Work, listen to this euphemism, he's an abortionist, it's titled Life's Work, subtitled A Moral Argument for Choice. He's a renowned and celebrated abortionist who claims to be a Christian, believes Christ has called him to perform abortions, and describes himself, quote, as a 21st century St. Paul preaching the truth about reproductive rights. He twists and torches the parable of the Good Samaritan to justify in the name of Christ the 10,000 abortions that he says he's performed over the last 15 plus years. With shocking candor on pages 94 and 95 of his book, Dr. Parker describes his abortion procedure in detail, innocuously describing his twisting the heads and the limbs off of preborn babies as, quote, disarticulation. Well, no matter how you say it, disarticulation or evacuating the uterus is taking a human life. If a man goes into a theater and fires away, killing several people in that theater, we don't say the next morning on the news that he evacuated the room. We say he has done a great moral harm. We are repeating history in America. The celebrated geneticist Jerome Lejeune, I'm sure it's a name some of you are familiar with, wrote this. He said, quote, at Nuremberg, talking about the Jewish Holocaust. He said, at Nuremberg, the horrible affirmation that a prisoner or a Jew is not a man, thus one can exploit him, had been condemned, it was believed forever. And yet that same twisted notion reappears today, modernized, disinfected, and miniaturized. An embryo is not a man or a person, thus, dot, 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 we can abort him or her. Compassion for the oppressed, a commitment to human equality, and a love for justice are the things that motivate us. This is why our services are free and theirs are not. Amen. Both the money trail and the blood trail lead directly to the abortion's door and to everyone who defends the slaughter of unborn children. Our opposition is principled, not selfish. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The government does not grant these rights. We believe that governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed in order to secure these rights. When the preborn are denied their God-given right to life, they are denied every other right, every other experience that God has intended for them as his image bearers. Abortion is is an affront to divine authority and the ultimate crime against humanity. Those who push the big lie do so to make you and I appear insensitive. But when you see with your own eyes what abortion does to little boys and girls, and I know most of you have seen that in this church, you recognize who it is that's being insensitive, and it is not us. It is not pro-lifers who are unfeeling. It is those who defend giving the death penalty to the innocent for the crimes of the guilty, helpless children, the innocent ones. And they depend upon lives to peddle this. In closing, I just want to read a couple of things to you. Isaiah 58, verse 6. I love this verse. Is not this the kind of fasting that I have chosen, to loose the chains of injustice, and to untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free, and to break every yoke? That is not the specific calling of Trinity Evangelical Church. That is the calling of every church. There is a scandal in the church with respect to abortion, But it is not that we have devoted too much attention to the preborn. It is that we have devoted so very little of our attention and resources to rescuing the least of these from the abortionist's knife. And this is no time. And I say this humbly this morning because I recognize the church that I'm saying this in. This is a church with a strong backbone for the preborn. But if I can spur you on to more good deeds, this is no time for Christians to be intimidated by fanciful lies. Let us find courage in the admonition of Frederick Douglass, the former slave and abolitionist, who, when speaking of slavery in somewhere around 1850, said something that's quite relevant, quite applicable to our battle for life. Here's what he said. "For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced." Amen. And that is what we have been called to do. If the church doesn't do it, nobody will. Amen. Amen. David, come on up and close us. Thank you. Thank you.